We'll just start with the testimony as we have been already. So with us today are staff from the different NINSCU systems. And first up we have Joanne Roach from my old alma mater and Don Graves from Rainy River, I believe. So both of you, welcome to the committee. Just introduce yourselves for the record and go ahead and put your testimony.
Thank you. It's with great pleasure I say thank you for inviting us, Mr. Chairman. Tommy is my representative. Good afternoon. My name is Joanne Roach. I'm representing the Minnesota State College faculty. That's the MSCF. I've been asked to give the new members of the committee a brief history lesson about who we are and how we got here, and then to take a few minutes to talk about some of the unique challenges that the rural colleges face. And then we have people here who are going to, they'll introduce themselves and tell you what they're going to do. We are the faculty teaching in the state colleges, which are the two-year institutions in Minnesota. MSCF represents about 4,000 full and part-time faculty in 6 community colleges, 7 technical colleges, and 12 combined community and technical colleges. We are the people's colleges. We are open-door institutions, which means that anyone with a high school diploma or a GED may enroll. Thanks to the foresight of many of our early legislators, the junior colleges and technical colleges in Minnesota have a long and impressive history beginning in the 1920s. It has been, however, in the last 15 to 17 years that I wish to focus, because I think we have experienced more change in that period than our system saw in their entire history. In 1991, the Minnesota legislature passed legislation that mandated that the technical colleges, the community colleges, and the state universities be merged into one higher education system, and that would become effective July 1st, 1995. The technical schools needed at that time to become colleges, and all of the programs in those institutions needed to be converted from hours to credit by the faculty. To be part of the merger, the technical schools also were pulled out of the local school districts and the instructors were made state employees. That was a process which demanded that the faculty form a new bargaining unit and negotiate a new uniform contract from all the individual contracts which were in place in the school district. This was a huge multi-year bargaining project. Shortly after the new NINSCU was in place, we received another legislative mandate to convert from the quarter system to the semester system, which called for a complete overhaul by the faculty of the credit delivery system for all courses and programs, the infamous semester conversion. As the system came together, many of the two-year colleges underwent more reorganization as they became co-located or consolidated colleges. In 2000, the two-year college faculty, many now on co-located or consolidated campuses and sharing space and resources, administration, faculty, and students, in a practical move, a voluntary move, merged the two existing faculty bargaining units, the United Technical College Educators and the Minnesota Community College Faculty Association, into one two-year college faculty union, the MSCF. This merger necessitated yet another massive change as negotiators tried to bring two disparate contracts together from two distinct educational traditions. Along with all the statewide changes, regional reorganizations also came and went. In my area, for instance, over the years we have undergone at least 3 regional reorganizations. We have now ended up as the Northeast Higher Education District. Similar reorganizations have taken place in all of the non-metro corners of the state, and even the metro schools or colleges have a loose association which they call the Metro Alliance. That is the tumultuous history of our organization, but there also has been a great evolution in instruction, which of course to the faculty is the heart and soul of what we're about. In terms of instruction itself, our system has seen great changes. Technical education has seen the incorporation of a liberal arts component in many programs. The integration was accomplished by technical and community college faculty. The two-year system has seen a comprehensive mission change over the years, from delivery of only college-level coursework to providing extensive developmental education in reading, writing, and math to bring large numbers of underprepared entering freshmen to college readiness. Because of the types of institutions we are and the clientele we serve and the way the world is today, we have been and are dealing with more and more troubled students with demands for special services, and we have been doing that with fewer and fewer counselors and resources. In the last 5 years or so, we have undergone yet again massive changes in the delivery of education, from the traditional classroom format that most of us are familiar with to the e-learning or online education. The conversion of classes and whole degrees to online offerings has been and continues to be accomplished largely on a volunteer basis by interested, dedicated, skilled faculty with little, if any, remuneration. Minnesota Online owes its success and growth to faculty who choose to give of their time and effort to create online opportunities in their disciplines and program areas. We are seeing even more changes now as faculty and counselors as we deal more and more with the PSEO program, with all of its ramifications, both good and bad, both on campus and in the high school. The program necessitates hours of campus and departmental discussion and oversight and considerable expenditure of faculty and counseling resources. Through the massive changes that we have negotiated in the recent years, the only constant is the faculty. I guess that's kind of my theme here. We are doing our jobs throughout all of this disruption and turmoil. Students, administrators, chancellors, legislative chairs, Tommy, and legislative committee members come and go, but only the faculty remain a constant. The governor now has indicated that we will be rethinking and reorganizing education in Minnesota yet again, especially in the high school. Changes will inevitably have a huge impact on higher education. We are used to change, as you could glean from my presentation here. We have important ideas and good opinions and ideas to back them up. We faculty are the one constant in higher education. Insist, please, that we have a seat at this table and listen to what we say. I've also been asked to provide you with some of the problems and challenges of the rural two-year colleges. I reside and work in Representative Rukavina's district on the Iron Range, but the challenges we face are no different than those of all of the other rural colleges. Sometimes we in the hinterland need to remind some of you that people do indeed live happy and productive lives in areas outside of the metropolitan area. And we need to live there. The farms are there, the timber is there, the iron ore is there, the lakes are there, the woods are there, the ski hills are there, the tourist attractions are there.
And Timberwolf.
Yes.
You play basketball that far north?
A major problem that we face in the rural schools is a result of the merger and the movement away from functioning as a unified system to being a collection of autonomous colleges. The old system operated under the Minnesota Miracle concept. The large colleges with huge enrollments shared tuition revenues and funding with the smaller schools to ensure that no matter where a student went to college in Minnesota, he or she was assured of an equal education. Now we operate like aircraft carriers. We are self-contained vessels staying afloat and functioning on our own. Rural schools don't have economy of scale. Most rural communities suffer from aging, declining populations. Keeping a full slate of offerings in our colleges is difficult, especially in higher level math courses, science courses, specialty courses, and some electives. We compensate in our region by sharing instructors. Some teach at more than one institution and are on the road. We broadcast math and physics courses over ITV, but that requires a good sending system as well as good reception and technicians at the receiving end. We often lose 15 to 20 minutes of instruction time to technological problems with ITV. Certain of our faculty in the region have developed online offerings to keep the needed low enrollment courses available to our students. Because of declining populations to draw students from, we must be creative in attracting new students. We are offering a business accounting degree, course by course, at Fortune Bay Casino. It's called College at the Bay, for casino employees and residents of the Tower area. We have developed a new industrial technology program in cooperation with the mining industry to help fill their employment needs as the baby boomers are retiring. Rural colleges are sensitive to the needs of area businesses and industry. We respond to failure and downturns quickly as well. Ironically, our greatest enrollment peaks happen and coincide with layoffs and business closures. We have difficulty following through with strategic plans and maintaining a vision or multi-year plans for our colleges with what we call in the faculty revolving door administrators who use our campuses as training grounds or stepping stones to the jobs they really want. Faculty in rural schools must wear many hats. We try to hire faculty with more than one credential, and the ones that we have, the faculty we do have, we encourage to obtain another credential. Our faculty have numerous class preparations in the rural colleges as well. Both of us in the rural colleges live under the constant threat of closure when elections change the governance of the state or the state suffers an economic downturn. We need to know, in conclusion, that you are committed to all of our colleges and that you understand what integral parts of rural communities our colleges are. Thank you.
Thank you, Joanne. Why don't we just hold questions for both witnesses? Don, why don't you go ahead? You got 2 minutes because Joanne took all your time off.
They knew I was going to.
Thanks, Chair Ruth.
Welcome to the
committee.
I'm just teasing. Why don't you just stay put there, Joanne? Stay put because I'm sure there's going to be questions.
Okay. Thank you, Chair Rukavina and representatives. It's an honor. My name is Don Graves. I teach at Rainy River Community College up in International Falls, Minnesota, obviously. And we're up on the border. It's kind of funny. I'm a biology instructor, but it's a small campus. I am the biology department. So, my purpose here today is just to talk a little bit about a project that we're very excited about up at Rainy River Community College. And that has to do with water. If you look at the handout that I prepared for you, very, very simple. We look around and we say, what are our assets? And you can see it. It's in blue. Okay? Water is one of our greatest assets. It's a great asset to our community. It's a great asset to this state. When we think about water in this area, we think about clean water legacy. We think about impaired waters, cleaning up impaired waters. Is there enough money in the governor's budget to clean up these waters? Some say yes, some say no. Where we are up north, we have relatively unimpaired waters. And it's a lot less expensive to keep clean water clean than it is to clean up impaired waters. So we're taking that asset that we have, this great asset, water. As part of the Minnesota Pollution Control Agency's Rainy River Basin Plan, completed a few years ago, one of the calls from all across that Rainy River Basin, and that goes all the way over close to the North Shore, all the way over to War Road on the west, way up into Ontario, Canada, and dips down into Itasca County. It's a great basin. And this Rainy River Basin plan called for the establishment of a water resources center, and it has four goals. The first goal was to act as a communicator, a communication between and among agencies and educational institutions and business along this international border. A second one was to educate, and that's where we come in. A third goal is to to be a data repository for information, for research coming in, done by researchers on this area. I mean, we're talking about areas like the Boundary Waters Canoe Area. We're talking about Quetico Provincial Park. We're talking about Voyageurs National Park. We're talking about the Lake of the Woods. We're talking about the Rainy River, a gigantic area. So where does Rainy River Community College come in? We hope to be able to start training some of the next generation of aquatic biologists, of limnologists, of water quality monitoring specialists. Well, we're only a two-year community college, so how do we do that? Well, we partner. Right now we're working with St. Cloud State University to write a National Science Foundation grant to get some funds to encourage underrepresented students to come up to this living laboratory that we have in the area. And so they'll come to a Rainy for 2 years. They'll transfer to St. Cloud State or Bemidji State as we prepare other articulation agreements. And so we're training this next generation to care for this resource that is so important to this state. So I guess because Joanne took so much time, I will close. We're a very small campus, but we think that we're making a very big, big difference to our students, to our communities, and to this state. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Before we get into questions, I'd like to recognize former State Representative Joe Opatz, who's here. Joe, welcome back to the... How's that high five doing, Joe? You get it there? That's good. Questions for the witnesses. Don, for you, what is the enrollment at Rainy River?
Chair Rukavina, the enrollment at Rainy River has been steady, I think, the last 4 or 5 years, at about 320 full time. So we're definitely the smallest, but we're steady.
And probably not only the smallest, but certainly the most isolated too. And
yes.
You had some students down yesterday that talked to me about the circles of excellence policy and the fact that, let's say RN program at Hibbing and the fact that you can't offer one because of that. Has that been a problem because of your isolation?
Yeah, the community is small, so we have had trouble, I think, attracting some technical programs. To me, it seems like we have to rely on places like Hibbing. You know, the hospital is small. There's not enough room for all of the clinicals that have to happen. So I think we have to depend on places like Hibbing for the RN.
And what do you do with the Boise as an example? Being that you don't have any technical programs supposedly there, when Boise asks you to do some training program or retraining like Joanne referenced with the mines and the et cetera, what happens then because you don't really have a technical school?
Yeah, we just received a block of grant money from the Minnesota Job Partnership, I believe. And the check was just signed over just last week, I believe. And that is to increase Rainy River Community College's participation with industry like Boise to do training for them right there in International Falls. So this is a really big deal for our community, and I think it will serve Boise very, very well. So we, even though we're small, I mean, there are lots of advantages. There are obviously disadvantages, but there are a lot of advantages.
Well, yeah, but an example, you can't teach a welding course. You don't have a welding teacher.
Correct.
Or whatever. So what do you do with this? Do you hire a person from Boise then with that, Jeff the Grant, and they come to the school?
Yeah, I think what Boise will do is come to the community college with a set of needs, and then once we determine, what those needs are, then we can go out and get those, get the personnel to work with Boise.
Representative...
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Actually, I have a question about, I represent a border community or county, and that's in the southern part of Minnesota, so we border Iowa. As a northern community, do you have a lot of Canadian students, and what's the relationship that you have as far as being able to have students from international students?
Mr. Green.
Representative Chair Rubina. We have a lot of Canadian students in my general biology class right now. This is general biology 2. I think I have 16, 17 students, and of those students, I have probably six or seven Canadian students. So our population of Canadian students is growing. I think back in the 80s, it was much larger than it is now. I think it probably had something to do with the exchange rate, but that seems to be getting better now. But yeah, we have a lot of Canadian students. I mean, right across the river, you know, a very short trip is Fort Francis. And, you know, we get students from Fort Francis and Devlin and all along the, you know, the river towns on the Canadian side.
Representative Portman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And the answer to this question might be longer than what we have time to hear, but from what I heard the first witness talking about, the legislature has made a lot of what I think of as micromanaging decisions for the state colleges and university system, from the merger of the technical schools to the switching over from quarters to semesters. And if you could just briefly explain what was the rationale for the legislature making that decision? You know,
I'm not exactly sure, but I think it had to do with the fact that I think it was a financial decision, that having to go through enrollment registration twice in a year instead of three times was a little bit more cost effective and less disruptive. There also is a feeling out there that you can get more into more depth in classes when you study the length of the semester rather than in the quarter. So I believe those are probably the two primary decisions.
It sounds like the motivation was saving money. I just wonder if you think the practical effect of those legislative decisions was actually to save money, both the merger and the switch from quarters to semesters.
Well, the merger one is a huge, huge question to answer right now. I think if you would poll most faculty, at least on our campus, and I'm speaking for our campus, most of the faculty are not really enamored of the semester system. You know, we live in, the students that we have right now have very short attention spans. Most of you know that. Video games or whatever it is. And we lose a lot of students before the end of the semester under the semester plan. We really do.
Ms. Novak, for point of clarification, if you want to address both of those.
Mr. Chair and members, the merger was a legislative action, but the transfer to semester base was made by the Board of Trustees, I believe, of MIMSCU. That was not legislative.
Mr. Berg, do you want to comment on that?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. We were mixing our signals here. It actually was in a bill. The Senate, for a number of years, had a regard for things that created uniformity, and they like common course numbering and common calendars and semesters. And the argument really was not a cost argument. It was more than anything that everybody else uses semesters.
Mm-hmm. In the olden days when I started college, the U was on quarters, and I thought that was a better system. And I think there's pros and cons for each. It seems like we should have room in our system for each, so that's why I was just curious about the rationale.
Representative Easton, but before you go, I see we got a senator here, Senator Sparks. Nice to have you over here. Do you want to come and sit with us, or no? Okay. Okay. Representative Easton.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Poppy asked the question about Canadian students. I guess where do most of the students come from? I mean, is there some kind of, are they geographically close to the area in the northern part of the state?
Representative Chair Rubina. Obviously, we pull a lot of students from the International Falls, Little Fork, Orr area. There's a good number of students from Fort Francis and the Canadian cities. But we have a student on the basketball team, a young woman from Las Vegas, Nevada. We have had students from Guatemala and Kenya and every point in between. So obviously most of our students are local. You know, Minnesota students. We have a really nice hockey club, not a team, but a hockey club, women's hockey club, and that is seems to be an outlet for a lot of students from various high schools around the state to come and play women's hockey.
Go ahead.
With the size being kind of small in that 300, how does that work when you scale your tuition? I mean, how does your tuition fit with the rest of the Minsky system?
It's the same. I mean, the tuition that students pay at Rainy River is the same that they would pay at, you know, at any other of the two-year community colleges. I mean, there is reciprocity with Wisconsin, and I know we have had some maybe with Canadian students, but I don't know if that's true any longer.
I think maybe what Representative Eastman's asking is, did your tuition hikes, were your tuition hikes at Rainy River greater than Mesabi's or Lake?
Well, Representative,
whatever.
Chair, I mean, yes, you know, they're going up higher than any of us like, and I'm sure that it does affect our enrollment. I mean, it's getting, the community college used to be the best deal in town. I think it still is, especially for those students in town, and, you know, the cost of living is less up north, obviously. But, yeah, it does. It takes a big chunk out of that budget, you know, that the student has to, you know, and I don't know the exact tuition numbers, but I think they're comparable in the Kneehead area, you know, those five campuses.
Representative Murphy.
Questions have been answered, Mr. Chair.
Representative Moe.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. To Representative Portman's question about co-location of campuses, Bemidji State University and Northwest Technical College were an example of that, and while there was some significant resistance early on, in particular amongst the faculty, I think the majority opinion now is that's been a great opportunity for students. And the articulation agreements that we have, well, actually, now it's seamless, pretty seamless, between Northwest Technical College and Bemidji State University. It has allowed us additional access to Rainy River and the surrounding community colleges that come from your area to be at Bemidji State University, easier for the students. So I think, in general, most people think that's a good idea now. Not at first, though. It's kind of mixed early on.
Representative Ruth.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm assuming you deliver the AA degree. I'm just wondering what degrees you do offer.
Representative Chair, you know, we have always been primarily a transfer institution, so students are earning their AA degree. We have an LPN, Licensed Practical Nursing Program. That's basically our only technical program. But students are there. They're there to be doctors and lawyers and accountants and whatnot.
Well, thank you both very much for your testimony. And next we have Suzette Overby and Cheryl Barton from Austin Riverland College. Welcome to the committee. Just identify yourself and go ahead into your testimony. Welcome.
Chair Gavina.
You bring any spam for us or anything?
Sorry. What was I thinking? I'm Cheryl Barton. I am in my 18th year of teaching. I teach at Riverland Community College at the Albert Lee campus. We are a co-located campus, campuses about 22 miles apart. The Albert Lee campus has maintained 24% of Riverland's full-year equivalent students over the last 2 years. I teach on the technical side of the two-year college system. I've gone from being part of that K-12 system where we taught the contact hours to the standalone technical college system where we were in quarter credits, to what the current system is now, where we would converted all of those quarter credits to semester credits. And now I deliver those credits two different ways, in face-to-face class learning and in online teaching, full online teaching. According to the Riverland Enrollment and Institutional Research Report, 26% of our students over the last academic year were still first-generation college students. And many of our students have to drive 30 miles or more just to get to campus. The face of our traditional and non-traditional student has changed. The traditional student may still be 18 to 25 years old, but many are culturally diverse, and English is their second language. Currently, we have more African refugees being from Sudan and Somali, besides our Hispanic population. According to Riverland faculty counselor Linda Bolt, those these students have not come to us as prepared as the wave of students that we had when we had the Asian immigrants. These students need to be able to access basic skill level classes or college prep classes in reading, writing, and math. The non-traditional student used to be 26 to 40 years old and come to learn a skill or trade. Now we see this age student and older who has come to learn a new skill or trade after losing a job. I have women in my program who earned good money in Wells, Minnesota, working for ConAgra Foods before it closed. Over the time these now non-traditional students have been working, they have lost some of their basic skills in reading, writing, and math. Some of these displaced workers are working at much lower paying jobs while they attend school. So now we have an older student in a classroom with fewer readiness skills, poorer paying jobs, and in most cases, families. And they're struggling to be successful. These college prep courses and English as a second language courses need to continue to exist, even with low enrollment. With the increase in class size requirements, these courses need to exist to get students ready to have a full set of skills for their college classes so that they can effortlessly transition to college-level courses, which can include on-campus and online learning. At a time when more jobs require higher education, fewer students can afford the tuition. This is what students have experienced: increased tuition, lower financial aid, and increased textbook costs. I think that tuition for an online one-credit class or a per-credit at Riverland is $150.50 as opposed to an on-campus cost of $130.50. Students are now caught in the gap of going to school and working. Currently at Riverland, 11.4% of our credits are sold as online courses. This is up 6.1% over last year, all while still costing $30 more per credit. If I were to ask why, I'd have to say because students think they can work and complete class offerings at the same time. The snag line for online courses is study anytime. Students have to find the time. Online learning requires you be disciplined enough to complete all the assigned material. This means be self-directed, self-disciplined, and have high reading and writing skills. For the technical college student who has come for hands-on learning, online is not the answer. This is not to say that a student isn't mature enough for college classes. This is about a student's learning style. For the student with high skills, I think online learning is great. I think students have the ability to shop coursework and instructors from all over the state. I think the online student can earn a diploma or degree they want, even if it is not offered nearby. This is a huge advantage for people in rural or outstate Minnesota. As an instructor, I now have two teaching styles. I attend to and give hands-on exercises to the students in my classroom. For online, I give directions, post information, add links, and open drop boxes. I was one of the last holdouts, I thought, to go to online learning. Directions given in a classroom are heard by everyone, and if one student asks a question, all of the students hear the answer. Directions given online are either not read or interpreted by the reader. The reader asks a question by email, and only that reader knows the answer. This is an example of individualized learning. This is labor intensive. This means that at some point in the evening or on a weekend, I have to say, I am not answering any more emails. Is this good for the student who's waiting for an answer so they can move on with their homework? Probably not. But faculty deserve a time off. You've probably heard this before, but online teaching is every day, all day. It's not easier, and it's not less preparation. Continued budget pressures will undermine the quality of education through greater dependence on part-time faculty and larger class sizes. I'd like you to remember that full-time faculty who are sitting right here and your committee's vice chair are committed to quality educational programs at our higher education institutions. I'd like you to remember that our libraries need to have an adequate collection of resources to meet student and faculty needs, and that our labs and classrooms from welding to biology need technology for adequate teaching and performance. We know that low education levels relate to low salary positions. So if we invest in higher education, you'll get a better economy and a better student.
Thank you. We'll hold questions until after Ms. Overby speaks. Go ahead.
Good afternoon. I'm Suzette Overby, and I teach at the Riverland Community College also. I'm in Austin, kind of as my home base, but I also teach in Owatonna. Last semester, I taught 3 days in Owatonna, which is about a 45-minute drive, plus I had classes also in Austin. So I also teach on ground or in the classroom, and I teach online. And I've noticed a significant difference in the students that kind of come into the online classes. Some of the issues that my traditional, you know, on-ground students face are some difficulties with high tuition rates. Some people, they definitely have work, they have families. I teach in the human services program, and most of my students are definitely older, non-traditional. Some are single parents, some are, you know, families that have lower socioeconomic status, and they do struggle to kind of make ends meet and to go back to school to get an education. Sometimes the child care grants that have been cut have really had a deep impact on the students in my program. The other thing that I think affects them is the class size. Just for an example, this spring semester, in my intro to counseling class, it used to be capped at 20 students, and it's a very interactive class, and it's a class that needs to be that way. But that was moved up to 30 students. My other classes have been gone from 30 to 35, just to meet the needs of what the administration is saying. Class size also affects the online student in many different ways. All the research that I've been doing lately suggests and really pushes towards the cap number in online classes to be at about 20. There's a lot of for-profit online institutions and online universities. And those institutions, if we compare them to our, you know, MinSU system, they only allow between 15 to 20 students maximum. The other research is saying that the optimal class size for online instruction is 15.9. I don't know how you get the 0.9 student, but maybe that one drops. But anyway, why that is because in order to provide quality interactive environments, we really need to be available for our students, not 24 hours a day. We do get, you know, some time off, like you suggested, Cheryl. But we do need to be responsive, interactive, provide an environment that is caring so students still know that they can approach us online. So that's one thing that needs to happen. Another rationale for this lower class size is that there's a high demand for immediate response. If somebody has a question or they have an issue, we do need to respond to that immediately. But, you know, I think about my traditional classes. If I meet with them one day a week, they're not pounding on my door every day or every 5 minutes, which is sometimes in the online environment. And we also need to be competitive, like I said, with the for-profit institutions. As far as some of the student needs for online learning is that they need technical support, and faculty need technical support. We need to learn as faculty how to teach online effectively and to be able to assess student learning in an effective manner. Faculty need to be skilled in teaching, and some of that stuff, some of that is coming from our technical side that we have. I see that gives us some of the information, but we also need new computers, we need new software, we need information that's going to be available for us. We also need for students quality online tutorials. I look at the D2L system, and some of the students are very ill-prepared when it comes to online. And so if there's a quality online tutorial, then they'll be able to navigate the system much more efficiently. And also library materials that are available online would be very helpful for our students. I don't see online as a substitute for traditional education at all. And not all students are appropriate. But I do think that students would benefit from, you know, some academic advising that would teach them or let them know what students would be more appropriate for online, as in they have to be more self-directed, they need to have better writing skills, and they need to be much more motivated than some of the traditional students that can just come in and kind of breeze by sitting in a lecture. Thank you.
Okay. Questions, Representative Bob?
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Glad you got that plug, too.
You betcha. That's a good thing. These are my colleagues, so but I just want to thank them for coming, because it does take time away from their students and takes time away from everything that they do in preparation for their classes. And so I'm thankful that they actually made the trip today in order to testify. So thank you.
We appreciate you being here, too. Is there a drop-off as far as a dropout rate between the difference between the online students versus the in the classroom students, for lack of a better word, either one of you?
You mean students who drop your class?
Yeah, right.
I don't know the percentage, I'm sorry, but I do, maybe you know.
Do you know the answer to that? I was just curious.
I would say, I think there are times that it's very high, but they've worked toward trying to eliminate that, and that may be part of the greater number of students that they're having in the online classes to begin with, because there's a greater number of drop-offs.
Representative Murphy.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Both of you spoke of training and needing IT backup. And does the system provide that for you? And does the system provide upgrading of your skills that you spoke about?
I think one needs to be assertive in asking for that. And I think we have to address our own needs. Sometimes I think that, for instance, like it would be really nice teaching online to have like a Breeze office hour, but I need to make sure that our system has Breeze capabilities available so that my students would know how to, instead of, it's like a virtual office hour and the students could come in and it's more, you know, synchronized. You can talk at the same time instead of having it, you know, the email system or things like that. So that would be really nice. But we tried some of those systems out, but we don't necessarily have that available to us at this time.
The state provides us with D2L as our device, and we have two people in an office of instructional technology located in Austin, which is not too helpful for someone in Albert Lea.
Or Owatonna.
Or if you're in Owatonna and have a problem. But that's just a case of a co-located campuses. Somebody can't be everywhere.
Mr. Chair, do they travel? Does the person that's supposed to be helping travel?
Sure, over the internet. Go ahead.
Mr. Chair and Representative, one day a week, one person comes to Albert Lea.
Mr. Chairman, I was interested in this conversation and the previous one, because when the students testified, one of the things they talked about was problems with online learning. And it seems to me somebody should be paying more attention to how it's being delivered.
Well, delivering, I think, faculty compensation as well, because there is a much more of a time commitment to course development, putting things out there, and then being available. And then making it an incentive for faculty to want to teach online. I think there's kind of a great fear in teaching online, because people aren't really sure how to do that or how to put their in-classroom skills into an online format, which is very different.
Mm-hmm. Representative Murphy.
Ms. Martin, you said that you were the last holdout, but now it sounds like you're committed if everything works fine.
She's going to be committed if they keep working on the conversation, right?
Or soon. Mr. Chair and Representative, I am committed. I have three classes out online now. I tried not to have to do it and then decided it's going that way. And I could probably help maintain my program since I'm on the technical side and attract more people by having the classes out online.
Representative Bryan.
All about numbers.
Mr. Chair, presenters, either of you could answer this. I'm wondering, when you originally choose to deliver a class online, is there an in-service available to you? Is there any special training opportunity?
Go ahead, either one of you.
Mr. Chair and Representative, we do have an in-service. It's a two-day session, and then you can schedule time to sit in the Office of Instructional Technology and with the two people that Riverland has and work with them. And I did it by working with them and going home and trying things and keeping a list and coming back and going through my list, and it's a lot of self-taught style.
I think there's also collaboration with faculty as well. You know, faculty helping faculty, and you know, what works for you and how can we do this, and that investment and that commitment.
Well, thank you both very much for your testimony. Yeah. Is there another question? Representative Welty. Excuse me. I didn't see Representative.
No, that's okay. Thank you, Chairman Rukavina. And I guess to both of you, has your institution kept track of the number of students your institution and then also the Minsky system? Have we been keeping track of the number of courses that are being online, the number of students that are served? Are we serving fewer or more with the same resources of staff? And then also the hours. I think you bring up a very good point about the hours that you're committing to serving online, and I know a lot of state representatives probably can be understand what you're going through because of email and talking to state representatives who served 20 years ago and the amount of work that they did compared to the state representatives now through email rather than letter, and the communication is just different. And so I'm wondering, are your institutions keeping track of the hours that you are putting in, and are they in any way making any attempt to compensate you for the additional time? Or maybe some people are putting in less time, but I guess if you have any insight into that, I'd appreciate your answer to that.
Either one of you want to tackle that one?
Mr. Chair, Representative, one thing I'm aware of, when you put it, for us, for me anyway, I think all of us, we have a $1,000 incentive if we're putting a new class online. And then through the IT department, I believe, is it $500?
We'll get that information from the
Minsky. There's an incentive, but I am not aware that they keep track of our hours.
That's a good question, ma'am.
I would like to say that that incentive is only on the liberal arts side and not on the technical side. So, if you're a teacher on the technical side, you don't get that incentive to put a class online. You just get... it's your regular credit, it's part of your credit load, and for the first time it runs online, you get one-third extra of whatever the credit was. So if you were put a three-credit class online, you get the additional pay of one credit. But otherwise, it's just part of your class load to make a full load or a full teaching load for the contract year.
Representative Ruth.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Well, can you set your hours? I mean, can't you say we're going to have class hours? You have hours at this time, and that they can get to you, so that you could set hours so that you wouldn't be.
In other words, you're not
available 24 hours a day. I mean, they need to respect it.
Go ahead. Either one of you want to tackle that?
Chairperson and representative. I believe you could set your hours, but if the point of online is so that students can work anytime and have their jobs. If I say I'm only going to answer questions between 8 and 5, I am not going to meet the student needs. And that's part of my responsibility as a teacher.
And then just a comment.
Go ahead.
Well, I'm from Latana, and I really appreciate what you guys are doing. And I just want you to know that Owatonna is an Owatonna College University Center, and Riverland is bringing the first 2 years of college work, and it is booming. I mean, Owatonna's bursting at the seams, so you do a great job.
Thank you. Thank you both for coming. And finally, on the two-year side, Kelly Smith from Anoka-Ramsey, Cambridge. Welcome, Ramsey. Cambridge. Welcome to the committee. And I hate to rush you, but I see the four-year folks are getting nervous back there. So.
Greetings, Chair Rukavina and members of the committee. My name is Kelly Smith, and I'm a nurse educator at Anoka-Ramsey Community College, as well as a member of the Minnesota Nurses Association Commission on Education. I am here to testify that we are facing many challenges in the field of nursing education. Some of the challenges we face are finding nursing faculty qualified to teach, keeping up with the rapid changes in healthcare and the needs of society, and educating and licensing the best nurses that are ready to enter the field. As you may be aware, we are in the midst of a nursing shortage, but we're also in the midst of a nursing educator shortage. The Bureau of Labor Statistics projects a need for at least 390,000 nurses with bachelor's and master's degrees in nursing by the year 2010. And we will need well-prepared faculty if we're going to educate these nurses that are needed. There are a multitude of reasons why nurse faculty are difficult to find to teach in nursing programs, especially our rural programs. The top reasons why nursing faculty say that they are not satisfied and decide to leave nursing education include the workload and the salary, according to a survey by the National League for Nursing. The nursing curriculum is constantly changing and must be updated, making preparation to teach time-consuming and labor-intensive. Nurse educators must also maintain clinical competence. Many of our state colleges have responded to the need for nurses by increasing enrollments of students in nursing programs. Unfortunately, this often occurs without adding faculty or additional resources. Too often, we see college administration reacting with quantity over quality in educating nurses. It is in the public's best interest to have safe and knowledgeable nurses, but this is time-consuming and expensive. But we feel there can be no substitute. Many of our state nursing programs have unfilled positions for nursing faculty. Even one or two positions left unfilled can have a huge impact on the workload of the nursing faculty who remain. Finding clinical experiences for students has become a challenge with the increase in student numbers and the changes in the 21st century healthcare system. Patients in the hospital are more ill and less safe for a student to care for without adequate supervision. Many of our state colleges still use the 30-year-old ratio of one instructor for 10 students on the hospital unit. This has become a large liability issue and makes it increasingly difficult to find clinical instructors. There is also the need in today's healthcare environment to keep up with technology. As you may know, hospitals are instituting the electronic medical record, but it can be different in every facility. Instructors and students must make the time to learn each system in every facility they practice in, taking up considerable time that is often not part of the academic schedule. Our students are changing as well. Many more students come into the nursing programs with limited English language skills. We know by experience and studies have indicated that this will increase the students' risk for failure. Students at risk need support to succeed, but the rapid pace and lack of resources allow too many to slip through the cracks and fail, and this further limits the body of practicing nurses that have a diverse background to serve the patient in the hospital. Also, more is demanded of today's professional nurse. Registered nurses do not practice as technicians, but are expected to take charge of the healthcare team. We need to educate nurses who can practice as professionals in a high-stakes environment. The public education system must evolve if it is to serve to educate nurses at a professional level. This would mean moving to a baccalaureate degree for all professional nurses entering practice. We need to be innovative and creative and thinking about how we can accomplish this in the state college system. We need to think about community colleges offering bachelor-level education for nurses. Several partnerships are formed by community colleges and universities to smoothly matriculate students into furthering their nursing degrees, and this is still a good investment. And finally, let us give nurse educators the status that would make it a more desirable career choice for the graduate degree-seeking nurse. Nursing education is a specialty with a scientific research base and a national certification through the National League for Nursing. We also need to close the large gap in salary for nurses with advanced preparation. This is a big consideration for recruiting nurses into graduate nursing education degrees when they know that they can make more money in non-academic positions. Thank you for your time and attention.
Ms. Smith, I think you hit on a very important point, and you know both the Minsky and the university are asking for money in the, you know, in those nursing fields and other fields. We'd like your more input when it comes time to it. for us to put this bill together, because I think you're bringing up a good point as far as the shortage. Representative Eastland.
Welcome to the committee, Kelly. You said that we need 390,000 nurses by 2010, is that right?
Yes, prepared at a higher level, at baccalaureate, master's degree level.
And what's our rate of achieving that at this point in terms of annually?
Considering, you know, if you were just going to look at graduating that number of nurses, that would be one thing, but we see a lot of nurses retiring. And especially at the more advanced levels, we have about 50% over the age of 50. So we can put a lot through the programs and still not keep up. It's just, there isn't the numbers. We have so many people leaving or retiring because of the aging of the workforce.
Yes, Representative Easton.
But I guess just as far, what I'm after is kind of in terms of capacity. What's the capacity that exists in the system now to create the nursing? People who have finished their nursing training and are ready to go into the workforce at the level you're talking about.
Ms. Smith, maybe I'm a bonehead, but I'm assuming that figure was a national figure, not a Minnesota figure.
Yes.
And so, what's the Minnesota figure on the ability of us to?
Representative and Chair Rukavina, I don't have a number for the statewide. Keep in mind that for a PhD level educator, the only program available is at the University of Minnesota for a PhD in nursing. So, yeah, we only have so much capacity for educating.
Okay, thank you very much for your testimony. Why don't we have the inter-faculty folks come up all at once, and we'll have Bemidji and Mankato in that order first. And can Ms. Anders, can you pull some other chairs up there from right here in front of us or wherever we can get them? And let's have Bemidji then and Mankato in that order, and then we'll go to the to Monty and then Nancy. Are you from around here?
No, I'm from Queens. Yes, we...
But I mean, you can come back if we run out of time.
Back.
Okay, that's the point. Right.
Do you want me to go first?
Yeah, I'm from...
No, I want Sonia to go first.
No, I'm going to have Roderick go first, and then Sonia. Okay. I get to chair this meeting. Because in case we run out of time, I don't want those two to have to drive.
Okay. Chair Chair Rukavina, members of the committee. I'm Rod Henry. I'm a faculty member in the Business Administration Department at Bemidji State U. Currently, I serve as the chief negotiator for the interfaculty organization, or IFO. I represent the faculty who teach at the universities that are the U in Minsk U. And it's my job today to let you know that my colleagues' ability to get their jobs done has been compromised through underfunding and misdirected funding. When I first came to the system about 25 years ago, we had faculty salaries that were at the top 25% in the nation for our type of universities. That gave us the ability to select faculty who would be able to give us the type of creativity and energy required to carry out our diverse mission as a complement to the technical and community colleges. We were able to get a good pool of candidates, which we were able to give them fair offers. That's no longer the case. We have a handout that's provided to you. It shows that now we're between the 40th and 50th percentile in faculty salaries. 40th and 50th percentile. Now we have to hire the faculty left over after other universities with better salaries have had their pick. Again, we're talking about comparable universities here. NCAA 2 class universities. The result of that is what I've seen in my own department. Searches for new and replacement faculty members that fail due to a lack of qualified candidates who are interested in the salaries we have to offer. We're going on year two of a search for a PhD in marketing that attracted a meager pool of applicants last year, still unfilled. Another result is an inability to retain faculty. Again, in my department, we had two PhDs, one in marketing, one in computer science. They were given tenure, then they left to get better offers in Louisiana, okay, due to issues of pay and workload. Overall, in the last several years, about one out of five faculty searches in Minsk U universities failed due to an inadequate pool of candidates, and in many successful searches, A lot of those people chosen were third or fourth choice. This represents long-term rot. It's been described that way by others. I'm going to use that same term. When it comes time to fix it, it's going to be a lot harder to do and a lot more expensive. Because of that, we need your help for several proposals. First, inflation. We have a $140 million request for 3.5% inflation adjustment each year of the biennium. This is not for future inflation. This is for past inflation. The last time we had an inflation adjustment was in the 2002-2003 biennium. We know that the phrase inflation adjustment isn't the sexiest one out there. You know, I mean, fixing a leaky roof, repairing a malfunctioning sewer, fixing a cracked sidewalk. It doesn't sound as exciting as, you know, starting some new institute, but you have to do it. It's the ounce of prevention you need. It saves you from having to pay the pound of cure. There are increases for different projects in the governor's budget, but they're not maintenance. They're new initiatives, and the problem is, unless these new initiatives are going to mysteriously vanish, completely vanish at the end of the biennium, guess what? We have more financial load that we have not kept pace with, that we're going to have to keep pace with in the future. Second, we have a request for $26 million to bring up our base salaries to a nationally competitive base amount. We also have a request for $15 million base increase to support salary equity. We recruit nationally and internationally for faculty. It's discouraging to have to go out to the marketplace with offers that are inferior to about half the ones out there. Governor Pelini has recognized the importance of competitive salaries in his proposal for the University of Minnesota's budget. He requested $28.5 million for that amount, and we need a similar amount. Now, the salary equity part of this, years ago, 1992, I was part of salary equity studies, trying to see if people were being paid the same for doing the same type of work, same type of preparation. Every time we've done these studies, we discover there are faculty out there who are underpaid, and every time it's time to fund these, to take care of this, we're told there's never enough money to fix this. And it should have been fixed a long time ago. This is something that's been hanging over the head of the system for the past 14 years. Earlier I mentioned some misdirected salary proposals. The ones that are out there that seem to be popular are various forms of performance or merit pay. And these can be given to either universities, the system, or faculty. First of all, we already have performance and merit pay in our contract. They're not explicitly called that, but we have them. If a faculty is given an extra assignment like running a workshop, doing an institute, teaching an extra class, you get paid extra for that performance. That's performance pay. As for merit pay, which is usually backwards looking, we don't have automatic tenure, not by a long shot. We don't have automatic promotions. If you get a promotion, and with that comes some financial incentive, you have to go through a rigorous process. Your department, administrators, all sorts of people are involved in that. Many faculty never achieve their highest rank of professor. Another thing about performance and merit pay, they don't add anything to the long-term base. They can be pulled or drastically changed at any time. I think Colorado is an example of that. If you look closely at the governor's merit pay recommendation, it's a performance pay. It's obvious that it's one-time money. It can go to the system office, the colleges or universities, or to the faculty. In short, we're not sure exactly who they're supposed to motivate. Lastly, another thing, one-time short-term grants, they aren't real pay. You can't count on them to pay the mortgage. You can't count on them to buy groceries or send your kids to school. And again, if it's new grants, this may require new overhead, new administration, which is another long-term burden on the system. Lastly, we already are extremely efficient. We feel that we're already performing. Compared to other four-year institutions in the state of Minnesota, in many cases our costs are significantly lower. We think it's due to the fact that we're teaching larger class sizes. So, in short, we've performed. Now we'd like to see the pay. In closing, let me thank you for your support of higher education in Minnesota. On behalf of the faculty of the state universities, I hope you will give us the necessary financial support to do our jobs well. Now I turn it over to
Ms. Myers. Thank you. And
Ms. Myers, welcome. Thank you. Chair Rukavina and members of the legislative committee focusing on higher education,
Thank you for your time and attention to higher education and for your service to the state of Minnesota. I'm always thrilled to be here and be part of this process. As I said, I'm Sonia Myers, an associate professor for 15 years at Minnesota State University. I teach nursing students at the undergraduate and graduate level, and I also serve as the graduate program's coordinator. We are faculty members who teach on campus, in clinical settings, in the community, and in online courses. Nursing education, as my colleague before me from the community college system said, is complex and ever-changing. Nursing faculty must have the expertise to teach students essential judgment skills in an ever-changing healthcare environment. Students learn to accompany persons in their birthing and their growing and their dying while accompanied by these expert faculty members. At MSU in Mankato in the School of Nursing, we currently have 300 students who are pre-nursing students, 300 students who are undergraduate students who will learn to be generalists, practicing, registered nurses, and we also have 60 enrolled graduate students. Of these, three of the four programs are year-round programs, and those are to prepare a fast-track graduate who already has a baccalaureate degree. 40 of those students are associate degree graduates of our community college systems who then want to increase their clinical judgment skill set. And 60 students are graduate students who are preparing to be nurse educators, clinical nurse specialists, and family nurse practitioners. And those students are enrolled in our primarily online program. However, this is the faculty picture. We have 33 nursing faculty full-time equivalent or positions being filled by only 17 full-time faculty members. 11 of those faculty members hold a doctoral degree. The remaining positions are being currently filled by part-time and adjunct baccalaureate and master's prepared clinical nurses who are really highly skilled clinical nurses but are not equipped to meet the learning needs of our students. In the 2005-2006 academic year, we had 8 positions open for full-time nursing faculty. We filled only one of those positions. The remaining positions are being filled with a revolving door of adjunct and part-time faculty who are having difficulty meeting the needs of our complex students. So why is that happening? Why aren't we able to recruit? There are about 3 or 4 reasons I'd like to share with you. First, the cost of doctoral education nationwide for nursing faculty have risen, and those who do go on to further their basic education are and become potential faculty members are really facing larger debt. The second reason is that competition in the service sector for master's prepared and doctorally prepared nurses is intense. In a recent survey of our own graduates, we discovered that the average salary for a baccalaureate graduate after 1 year of experience is $49,000. The average salary for a nurse practitioner in specialty care that we prepare is $74,000. The starting salary for a master's prepared assistant professor nurse educator is between $40,000 and $45,000. Nurse educators live in this unfortunate paradox. That is, more education may lead to less salary. Now, I'm not saying these aren't fair salaries. They are. I grew up on a dairy farm. I know you can make things stretch. But what our issue is we can't attract faculty, and that's creating a huge burden for those of us who are left and wondering what's going to happen in the future. In addition, in the service sector, there's really highly aggressive academic recruiting. For instance, we lost one faculty member 2 years ago because she instead accepted a position in Vermont where the legislature offered her a $10,000 student loan forgiveness. The school offered a salary competitive with the service sector, and they also paid her relocation expenses. We were able to match the salary through working with our administrators, but not the other two. She liked us in our program, but not in our package. Currently, we are recruiting for 9 open positions. Our budget allows us to offer high or matching salaries for only 1 or 2 of these positions. And finally, we are facing retention issues because current faculty members are being actively recruited on a regular basis. So I'd like to ask for just a couple things. I'd like you to support the Minsku request for a 3.5% inflation adjustment to help us in our recruiting efforts. And second, be cautious of any funding requests to promote increasing the number of nursing graduates without specific reality-based benchmarks that increase numbers of qualified nursing faculty. Thank you for your time. I know you'll do the right thing. Thank you for supporting nursing education and the health of the state of Minnesota.
Thank you, Ms. Mines. We'll hold questions. Mr. Hugh, is that right?
Chairman,
you might want to get over to the mic.
Full Monty here. So.
just for the record, I like that. Just so you're recorded for the record.
Thank you for this opportunity. I've given hundreds of talks over the past 35 years, but not one of them has been as personally satisfying as a commencement address I gave last month at the Minnesota Correctional Facility in Redwood. As I stood before that assembly, I turned to the 10 graduates and shared my secret. Nearly 44 years ago, I too had received my high school diploma there, behind what Bob Dylan called the walls of Red Wing. If anyone in 1963 had predicted that Monty Butte would one day be testifying before a House committee as a professor of a state university, my former teachers, classmates, and fellow citizens of Jackson, Minnesota would have suggested that you were a few cards short of a full deck.
Or that this was the Criminal Justice Committee.
So how did this improbable chain of events come to pass? After I was paroled, I headed to the Twin Cities and soon found myself making notepads in the basement of the Pillsbury Company. By chance, I met a company attorney, and he took a paternal interest in me. And one day he said to me, "Kid, you're really not as stupid as you appear to be. Have you ever thought about going to college?" I landed at Austin Junior College on the fourth floor of the high school. Even for a long shot like me, it was a chance worth taking. They had open admissions, and the tuition was the semester equivalent of $7.50 a credit. In what turned out to be a lucky twist of fate, I signed up for a humanities course with Rodney Keller. He saw in me a potential that had been invisible to my family, my K-12 teachers, and most of all, myself. For the next couple of years, he became my teacher and my mentor. Returning to the Twin Cities, I enrolled in a new junior college that had just opened on the third floor of Minneapolis Central High School, now known as Minneapolis Community and Technical College. The price was right. As I remember, tuition was $8.25 a semester credit. Once again, fortune smiled on me. The first class I took was with Audrey Parrish. With her generous and learned tutelage, I began to fulfill my destiny. I was soon admitted to the University of Minnesota in 1967, where my tuition was the semester equivalent of $10 a credit hour. I expressed my heartfelt gratitude to Professors Keller and Parrish the only way I then knew how. That first term at the U of M, I received straight A's, a 4.0. I share this personal story today to put before you both a human face and a sense of history. First off, if I were paroled today from a correctional facility, the chances of my acquiring the public education needed to become a college professor would be little better than my chances of winning the Minnesota State Lottery. The $7.50 I paid at Austin has now escalated to more than $130. The $8.25 per credit hour I paid at MCTC has now spiraled to $141. And the $10 I paid in 1967 at the U of M has soared to $275. Now, without question, inflation has played a role in this mind-boggling rise in tuition. However, inflation is little more than an accessory to the crime. When it comes to ever-increasing tuition rates in Minnesota, the crime scene is the state capital. In the early 1980s, the state's share of public higher education was 80%, while students picked up 20% of the tab. For the next two decades, the state roughly picked up two-thirds and students one-third. Since 2002, public college students and their families have been swamped by a tuition tsunami. The state's commitment to sharing college costs has shrunk to 50%. Students at the state universities usually come from humble origins and possess modest means. Make no mistake, these students are as intelligent and capable as their counterparts at private colleges or the University of Minnesota. However, our students routinely experience difficult life circumstances. They work far too many hours, usually at low wages. They face conflicting family obligations. They take more credits than they can handle. And given the state's tuition policy, end up with debt that seems as insurmountable as that of the Ford Motor Company. In Minnesota, quality education should not be limited to the well-to-do. Given the high demands of high tuition, work, family, and school, our students probably are doing as well as could be expected. Nevertheless, these no-win choices that students come up against may well be limiting their opportunities. If they choose to shortchange their studies for work, will they achieve the level of proficiency that savvy employers are today requiring? A recent national survey of over 300 employers found this. Fully 63% of business executives interviewed agreed that too many college graduates do not have the skills to be successful in the global economy. This study also revealed the skills that employers most desire. 1, teamwork. 2, critical thinking and analytical reasoning. And 3, oral and written communication. Now, when these business leaders were asked what type of education would they recommend to a young person they knew, 3 in 4 said they would suggest a liberal education. The British novelist Doris Lessing once made a forthright assessment of how difficult it would be in the 21st century for political leaders and educators to foster education for the long term. Quote, all the pressures go the other way, towards learning only what is immediately useful, what is functional. More and more the demand is for people to be educated to function in an almost certainly temporary stage of technology. Education for the short term. Thanks to professors like Rod Keller and Audrey Parrish, I received a useful education for the long term. And thanks, too, to those visionary political leaders of the 1960s and the 1970s, whose long-term investment in my generation's higher education continues to this day to pay high dividends for the state of Minnesota. I ask you, as state legislators today, to do no less for our children and for our children's children. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Finally, we'll have Ms. Black. Before we do, Representative Bly moves the minutes of last Thursday's meeting. Any additions or corrections? If not, all those in favor, signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed, same sign. Thank you. Ms. Black, welcome.
Thank you, Chair Riccovino and members of the committee. Monty Butte is always a hard act to follow.
That's why you're trying to get him in front of you.
I'm a faculty member at Metropolitan State University. Currently, I'm on leave as the president of the Interfaculty Organization, or IFO. The IFO is the union that represents more than 3,200 full and part-time faculty at Minnesota's 7 state universities. We are the people who teach approximately 57,000 full-time equivalent students seeking baccalaureate, master's degrees from state universities, and we produce the mid-level professionals in our society, the nurses you've heard about, engineers, accountants, and over half the teachers in the state. I've been proud to teach at Metropolitan State University for more than 15 years, and I look forward to returning to Metro when my IFO term is completed. Today I want to talk a little bit about who the faculty are, what we do, why it is important, and why we hope you will invest in higher education at the state universities. We are broad access institutions. We don't cherry pick and only admit the top 5 or 10% of the class. We take students, many of whom are in the middle or even lower half of their class, and we help make successes of them. And we are efficient. The total expenditure per student, both tuition and state appropriation at state universities, is about half of the expenditures per student by private colleges. We think what we do is important, that we add value for individuals and Minnesota society as a whole. There's a strong correlation between people's level of education and the income they earn, as well as the job security. I've passed out a chart. The first one is this white sheet of paper that says education and training pay. And if you look at it, you'll see it documents that the more education a person achieves, the less likely they are to be unemployed, and the more money they will make. We give students access to careers they could not achieve without higher education. But we do more than just give people access to jobs. We give them the skills that help them to be smart consumers, wise investors, effective parents, and civil leaders. Many of our graduates end up on school boards, city councils, and even as legislators, including 6 on this committee. Higher education is an investment. You get paid back in the future for the expenditures you make today. Because educated people make more money, they pay more taxes, and the state gets a direct return on their investment. I passed out another chart for you, the green sheet that I'll call. This is from a recent issue of a newsletter called the Post-Secondary Options. It shows the percent of taxes paid by educational level. So, for instance, if you look, people with a bachelor's degree make up 18.4% of the population, but they pay more than 28% of federal taxes. Higher education at all levels, not just state universities, pays big dividends. At one time, Minnesota was a leader in the support of higher education, but sadly, our standing is quickly falling. Each year, Governing Magazine, a publication for state and local government officials, puts out a ranking of state appropriations per capita on higher education. And that's your buff sheet. In the classroom, they call me the queen of handouts. But people often question, where do you get this information from? And so that's why I'm providing it to you. If you look at this first page, where it's highlighted, 4 years ago you'll see that Minnesota ranked 20th among the 50 states. This year, Minnesota has slipped to 30th behind Mississippi and Alabama, and that's documented on the reverse side of the sheet. A little over a month ago, the Chronicle of Higher Education published a comparison of higher education funding increases between last year and this year. I distributed a copy of that ranking. Minnesota had a 2.6 increase. We ranked 45th. Only 5 states had a smaller increase. But I'm asking you to please look on page 3 if you turn it over, and you'll see the situation is far worse in the distribution of that increase. The U of M had a 4.8% increase, financial aid had a 3% increase, but Minsku only had 0.2% increase, the smallest of almost any system or institution in the nation. In fiscal year 2006, which ended June 30, Minsky received a state appropriation of approximately $600 million. 4 years earlier, in fiscal year 2002, Minsky received $601 million. In other words, Minsky institutions received less actual dollars than 4 years earlier, despite the fact that inflation grew at nearly 12% over those same 4 years, and enrollment grew by more than 8,000 full-time students, the equivalent of a good-sized university enrollment. Or if you want to think of it as a picture, that would be the total enrollment of undergraduate and graduate programs at Hamline, McAllister College, and Concordia in Moorhead combined. Minnesota has been coasting on our past reputation for a long, long time. At a time when higher education is more vital than ever for success, other states are passing us by. The primary reason my family moved here 20 years ago was the quality of education. I'm not sure we'd make the same decision today. My plea today is that you make higher education a priority again, that you fund inflation for higher education, all of higher education, not just state universities and not just Minsky. In the past 4 years, because the state didn't fund inflation costs, these costs pushed on to students and faculty. Student tuition rates at state universities went up 53% in 4 years. We believe the state should pick up inflation costs this time. It's their turn. On behalf of all the faculty at the seven state universities, thank you for all your efforts and support of higher education.
Thank you, Ms. Black, and I don't think the committee will mind seeing a little bit the first questions. Representative Breiner.
Mr. Chair, presenters, more by way of comment. First of all, we know what an excellent job you do. So just be aware of that. You've done an excellent job today in laying out the challenges you face, both in staffing, salaries, and student costs. And it'll be our challenge to see if we can accept your challenge to address those issues. But thank you very much for your work.
Representative Moe.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. My friend Professor Henry laid out a pretty compelling case in the beginning, which you all gave a different take on, which we appreciate. As you know, I'm an IFL member as well. However, I'm an IFL member that's a part-time student that you suggested might not be, for whatever reason, delivering his quality and academic opportunity to our students. I think there's a couple of challenges here, and maybe anybody can respond to this. Professor Henry, perhaps, be the best one. I would contend that Minsky is hiring more part-time faculty like myself, primarily out of financial reasons. It's a better financial deal for them. Our salary has gone up zero in I can't remember how long. And maybe you could comment on that. And the other
same here.
Yeah, right. Yeah. That resentment's only hurting you, Mr. Chairman. And the other question I have then for you is, as you know, Bemidji State University and many all other Minsky's institutions do this. We deliver programs all across northern Minnesota and actually far beyond. And online delivery is how many students in northern Minnesota get their teaching certificate and other fundamentally important programs for Minnesota. I would contend that I think that's a good idea, that we need to work through those solutions, and maybe you could comment on, from an IFO perspective, what you would need in order for us to continue to develop that in that direction.
Sure. First of all, relative to the pay for part-time adjuncts and professors, actually it flip-flopped. In the last contract, part-time and adjunct professors didn't receive a raise in their base, even though we asked for one. The negotiators on the other side weren't interested in it. However, in the contract before, you folks received a raise when the other faculty didn't. So it kind of flip-flopped. I know the most recent one is the one you're going to be looking at the closest, but it's just that's just how the situation was, and it was the peculiarities, I think, of the last two rounds of negotiation. Now, as for the, and by the way, this current time, we're going to do our darndest to get, make sure everyone's going to be benefiting. As for the online, right now as we speak, I have 60 students online. And every time, and I, in terms of where they come from, I have students in Moldova. I have students somewhere near Fallujah. I have students in Canada. I have students in Colorado. And they come online, they've got questions, they've got concerns. All different times of the day, other people have spoken about this. I have online office hours. Another one of my colleagues who does a lot of service this way, Tom Fartall, he has online hours as well. And the last three times we've been bargaining, we brought forth a proposal to have a course load equivalency for online students. Because, again, in some cases, it's the system that a student has to use, and in some cases, it's going to require a lot of coaching, hands-on, et cetera. And it can be, from my own experience, it can be small things. For example, I always pick textbooks that have a lot of resources with them. Well, you get a textbook with three CDs, maybe you need, you know, a hands-on drill showing you how to get through that data set that shows real estate values in Denver, Colorado. You know, those type of little things can hold up students. And again, if you're on an internet link 8,000, 9,000 miles away, you've got to have that. So, again, we feel there's a way to turn that into course load equivalency so you're going to have a more regularized standard, a better way of making sure people are getting the quality they need online.
I just want to say, Mr. Buta, I appreciated your testimony. And, you know, members, even with the governor's infusion of about $400 million or so, roughly, in this committee, let's just take the Minsky request for $171 million, I believe, which had a 4% increase built in, tuition increase built in with that request. So when we look at the one-time money and the base and what the governor actually gave Minsky, we'll take them. I think it's about $93 million when we back that money out, give or take.
Ongoing, it's
less than that.
72.
Okay, so here we are now, less than half. So what happens then if we do that is we just increase the student's tuition from a 4% built-in increase to an 8 or better. It's not only a problem what's been going on recently, it's an absolute crisis. We've had students in front of this committee for 3 weeks now who have told us horror story after horror story. And, you know, Monty, if we were doing to you when you got out of prison and went to school what we're doing to them today, you'd be back in prison because I don't think you'd have been able to pay the bill and who knows what choice you would have made. We got some really tough decisions to make. I'm glad we heard from you today, and I hope that maybe our targets are bigger than what the governor gave us, because if they're not, we've got some tough decisions to make here. In the end, it's the students that are going to suffer. Mr. Butte.
Thank you, Chairman. I just, too, want to remind the committee that, you know, a WAG said of a former president that he was a man who was born on third base and thought he hit a triple. It'll come to you to think about it. There are colleges and universities out there for people born on third base. There are colleges and universities out there for people born on second base. But for people who are born on first base, or like me, we're just damn glad to get a chance to get up to the plate and bat. The Minsky system are their colleges and universities. Remember that the people that are most affected by these actions are those people who are either born on first base or who are just glad to get a chance to get up to the plate and bat. Thank you.
Thank you. Well said, and with that, members, meeting is adjourned. Okay.